Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Today we're going to take a look under the hood of the man with the money in New South Wales, Treasurer the Honourable Mike Baird, who had a very successful career in banking before leaving it to study the ministry at Bible College, then climbing the stairs up into Parliament House at Macquarie Street in 2007, becoming the Shadow Treasurer in 2008. Mike, thanks for coming by Open House. You'd witnessed all of the highs and lows of your dad's political career, Bruce, as a little boy. And yet here you are in politics.
I think like most sons, well, you're either desperate to do exactly what your dad did, or I think most try and carve their own path out, and I was definitely that case. I thought anything but. I mean, I admired what my father did immensely, but there were many scenes. You saw all of the downside, and yeah. I remember many of those days and nights, and I thought, listen, good on him, but I do not want to do that. So I sort of headed on a path for a long time where I tried to do my own thing.
In spite of your foreknowledge of what politics was like, what were the biggest surprises when you made it into the bear pit?
Well, so I don't think anything prepares you for it. And I mean, I've described it as almost, you can watch a bullfight, but until you're the matador holding that red cape, you don't really know what it's like. And certainly, I'd put myself in that category. I mean, I think I was surprised by the demands. I mean, I worked in the finance sector, and you know, one of the things my wife and I, when we're talking about this path, was, well, at least we know that I'm not going to work harder. So that is something that's become a surprise, because you do. I mean, the demands are around the clock, and they yeah. stretch well into weekends, and protecting time for family and friends and church is an important discipline, but it needs to be a discipline, because otherwise you'll be swamped by it. So that was a surprise. I think the, you know, the depth and passion of hatred that can kind of come through in some of the correspondence and passions around issue, that, you know, that also was a surprise. But on the other side, I think the surprise is, until you dive deeply into your community, you can often walk right through the middle of it and not be aware of some of the most incredible people in the most amazing services, make a huge contribution, you know, to some of the most vulnerable people. And you put your head on the pillow of the night, you wouldn't even know they're there. And, you know, that has been, you know, probably the most fulfilling part, to know the most amazing stories and services and having a capacity to actually help them, whether it be mental illness or domestic violence or teenage crisis accommodation. You know, there's a whole range of people that I sit back at each day and just go, listen, we are a very lucky place to have people like these operating. So,
what do you consider a successful day?
Well, my birthday was yesterday. That was a good day.
In so much as you've had another one, that's clearly a success.
I think a successful day is where you move forward. The big challenge in this role, and it's senior roles in corporations, NGOs and others, is that you become not a victim, but you become dictated to by the agendas of others.
Yeah.
And I think that each day you have a capacity to drive your agenda or the collective agenda of government or the community that you're part of. If you inch forward on that, well, that is a good day, rather than being responding to the events and circumstances around you.
How do you deal with the lag time between a great idea and it coming to fruition in a bill, and then in turn waiting for it to bite, this decision, once it makes it through Parliament and it comes out the other side and it's now legislation, and we build something or we clear a space for something or we provide a grant for something, even then there's no result. How do you deal with that?
No, it is. It's true, actually, and it's probably one of the big frustrations. I mean, patience is not my strength, and I do struggle with some of the timeframes. And I've looked at the public service on occasions, and they'll tell me that something will take 6 months. And I'll say, well, it should be done today. Well, you know, why can't it be done today? And yeah. And there's often good reasons that things have to be considered, and due process is helpful. But, you know, I think, so two events come to mind. I think the Northwest Rail Link is a good example where previous government had spoken about it for a long time, indeed promised it would be built by 2010, but they never provided the money for it. Mm. So you know, one of the things I've done collectively with the Transport Minister is, and obviously the Premier through his leadership, it's we are going to deliver this, and it's going to take some time. So my job in that is to find the money within our capital and our forward estimates to keep the rating, but to get the funds to it. And we are starting to see that take effect. So the boring machines actually go into the ground, and the Premier and the Transport Minister are rightly at those events, but I take pride in them as well, because it's been not just myself, but there's a collective government effort to delivering that. And as you start to see it happen, and we're 3 years in, so it's a long time, it is a positive. There's a sense, well, each day we've been working towards it. As I said, if we're inching forward each day, well, we're now starting to see the fruits of that labour, and that does give you a sense of satisfaction.
Mike, you've been heavily involved in the federal government's infrastructure top-up program, whereby if a state sells off or privatises one of its assets, the federal government will top up that money as long as all of that money is then ploughed straight back into infrastructure. There has been some concern around this that the states are selling off their silverware, and at some point we're going to run out of it.
No, I mean, this is the part of this debate, I think, has been very helpful. And ultimately, what we said, okay, if we've inherited a set of books, and that those books showed, and indeed economic circumstances, that revenue was significantly falling. So we lost billions of dollars in revenue, almost about $2.5 billion a year worth from when we came into government. Debt was rising, and we had effectively right on the AAA rating. Now, if we lose a AAA rating, the cost of the state is forecast to be about $3.75 billion over 10 years. So we can't lose a AAA rating, but we have revenue down and debt against our limits. So what do we do? Well, we've got all this infrastructure that requires to be built. So it like a household or a business, to go, okay, well, what have we got on our balance sheet? And can we turn, and this is the important point, can we turn an old asset into a new asset? And that's really what we've done. So the long-term lease of the Port Botany, will the funds from that will put into the government's contribution to the WestConnex project. It was also money into the Princess Highway, the Pacific Highway, the Bridges to the Bush program, a whole range of infrastructure projects that otherwise wouldn't have been built. So we've taken that capital and put it into new assets for the state. So people say, well, you're selling the silverware. No, you're turning a fork into a knife. I mean, or a knife into a fork. I mean, it is really one asset going to a new asset. Some of that is not necessarily income generating, like these current assets are. Mm-hmm. But you're receiving value for those revenue streams at the sale price. Provided you sell it for more than those future income streams are worth, then you are winning at every turn. And I think the community has started to accept that. And when you look at the Newcastle transaction, we've said, listen, we're going to lease the Newcastle port, but importantly, we're going to put a huge part of the contributions to regenerating that city, an urban renewal project, unlike any that has been seen. They've spoken about that for 20 years. And the problem has always been, well, where's the money coming from? Well, the good news here is it's going to happen, and the money has been identified. And on the ground, they're very positive. You know, so you get the new assets, you get that renewal they've been desperate for on the basis of the transaction. So old for new has started to get some community resonance, I think.
And while we're focused on that bright, shining future for a state, sometimes people get left behind. Not intentionally by governments, they just fall through the cracks. Who are the people that are on your heart that we need to support right now?
Yeah. Well, it's a really important question, and I don't think policymakers do it enough. The day-to-day were in the chaos and the shiny opportunity of big new projects. I mean, that's where often all the focus is. But you're right, there is a group of Australians or a group of people across New South Wales that are struggling. And there is a big capacity and onus, I think, on government and policymakers more broadly to look after them. And as we've framed each budget, I've had three pillars. I mean, the first is to improve services, the second is to build infrastructure, and the third is to look after those most vulnerable. Now, there's a range of things that we have done. One of the things that we've announced as part of the budget process is we've actually increased the pay, well overdue pay rises, into our social services sector and the community sector workers. So that was a long-fought case, and one that I was very happy to provide. I mean, there are people in there that work with incredible volunteers on the smell of an oily rag, and they're looking after the victims of mental health and domestic violence, and they are really doing the most noblest work you can imagine. But specifically into your question, at the moment I have this deep sense of the teenagers. Youth unemployment is a significant issue for this state, indeed across the country. I've spent a bit of time with teenage crisis accommodation, and when you hear some of these stories, and this is the thing that I think politicians need to do, is go and talk to people in their circumstances, talk to these kids, and you can't imagine it. I mean, we all have challenges and struggles in life, but I've met some kids. The cards they have been dealt is beyond any sense of comprehension or understanding that I can gather. How can a young kid have to go through all of that? And to know that there are services around them that are giving them an opportunity to move forward, well, from my point of view, that's what makes the job worthwhile. So, how can I, in this role, how can we as a government to support, to give some of those, they're not just names and sort of make-up stories, they are real kids living real lives, and how can we make a difference to them? And they're some of the things that occupy me as we bring the budget together.
Whenever a person of faith steps up into a spotlight, there are always competing forces at play. How does your faith intersect with your public service?
Well, I think the onus is on every Christian. One of the struggles that I used to have was a separation. I used to think that work was on one side and my Christian faith was on the other. And there was a lifelong wrestle, a 10-year, 15-year wrestle, can you bring the two together? And I certainly believe that, and that was part of the reason I'm now in politics as opposed to what I was doing previously. I thought that maybe this, for me, and it is a personal thing for every single person. There's no sort of same path for everyone. Maybe that was the place. I think that my role in this is to live, a faithful life in my role. But I don't see my role as having to go into the parliament to legislate what I believe. Sure, there'll be conscience votes, and that's going to impact. Your faith obviously has an impact in relation to the way you might respond to conscience votes that others bring forward. But I don't see my role as going out there and getting everyone to live the way, legislate the way I think they need to live. Others might see it that way. There are others that I think strongly believe that I should be doing more of that. I don't see it that way. I think that all of us, whether we're accountants, whether we're in NGOs or the community sector, wherever we might be, we have a chance and an opportunity to bring what we believe into the way we go about our day-to-day. And whether it be looking after our customers, looking after our employees, engaging with our boss, engaging with anyone at the corner store, there is an opportunity in that interaction to reflect what is most important to us and to live a life that reflects that faith.
What is it you'd like us to understand about life in politics? You meet a lot of people and you probably come across some pretty big misconceptions. What are those and what can we do to fix them?
Listen, I think that one of the things, talking more broadly, I think in a church context, I think the church is sadly absent from a lot of the day-to-day debates, and it'll occasionally appear at great points of principle, whether it be conscience votes in Parliament or others, but it to me it seems to be sort of sadly lacking in the day-to-day, and what I mean is it'd be fantastic if churches across the state went down to their local parliamentarian and forget the political badge. It's not significant.
They're our spokesperson.
That is the person that's in there, that's leading the community, and saying to him or her, listen, we appreciate what you do. We just want to know that we're here supporting you in any way, shape or form. There'll be matters that may come along that are of interest to us and we'll engage with that, but we want to thank you for what you're doing and support you in that. I think that could be transformational for the church, because really it is a lonely, lonely place. I've never known such loneliness, and it's crazy because you're busy from 6 a.m. to 11 o'clock at night. You've got your family, you don't see your friends as much, but I can tell you that in amidst that 6 a.m. to 11 o'clock every day, and it's not me, it's every politician, you have deep moments of loneliness because you have very little real interaction with people. People have you along to an event as someone who's in a title, not as you, the person. And that is wearing. You know, that is incredibly wearing, because you just want to scream out, listen, it's Mike, you know. Forget the title, forget whatever job I'm doing. You know, I want to talk about the footy. I want to talk about the struggle with teenage kids. You know, I want to ask how the heck I get the weeds out of my gutter. You know, they're real life issues that you often don't get a chance. It's almost for Pollies, you know, I think there's almost as a sense as if you look down on the playing field and you never get the chance to play. You know, the things that, well, not necessarily things you really enjoy, but the real life interaction and discussions you're almost prohibited from doing. So I think in a church context, and even beyond it, you know, a broad community context, taking the time to get to know, you know, your poly as a person, encouraging them as a person. You don't have to agree with everything they do. Indeed, you know, most of my good friends, you know, vote the other way. But you know, there's a sense that they know who I am, warts and all, and you know, that's just unfortunately something that gets lost in the political process.
Is this exactly where you wanted to be in this job, taking this role at this time in your life?
Yeah, I don't think anyone can say that, you know. But I always thought that when the door opened, I mean, I went that wrestling life I've spoke about, where you know, I didn't want to get to my last days, and you know, a couple of years ago, my grandmother passed away, and I remember seeing her about half an hour before she died, and I thought, yeah, that's the moment right there. I didn't want to get to that spot and to have deep regret looking back. You know, I always wanted to have a sense that whatever I did, there was a contribution. There was a contribution to, you know, my community, the state, country, in some way, shape or form. I left, you know, what was dear to me in a better place than when I came. And ultimately, that led me to turn my mind away from banking to maybe becoming a church minister. So yeah. I went to a theological college, and yeah. I thought I was a church minister. But there, when I weighed everything up, it's where I finally said, hang on, you know, remember when you looked at what your father's involved in and the upside there? Well, maybe that's the same place for me. And once I had that thought and cleared, spoke with a number of people and Christian people I respected and my wife, obviously, at the top of that list, we thought, well, actually, maybe it is politics. The moment I did that, having spent the time in banking, I thought, you know what, where I think it all comes together is probably in the treasurer role in the state. So that was, when was that, back in about 95, so it's almost 20 years ago, that I thought that maybe everything would come together in this particular role. So, listen, it wasn't as if I planned it this way. I guess it was a vision that I held dear to, and a hope that I held dear to, that I guess I'm fortunate enough has come to fruition.
Last question. Everybody wants a goal. Everybody wants us to work towards something. As a leader, as a politician, you'd like us to gaze with some expectation at some part of our future in New South Wales. What is it?
That's a big question. As in personally or for the state or...
Your call. But I'm interested in what is at the top of your food chain. What do you want the rest of this state to look at on the horizon and say, see that there? We're going there. I'm really excited about it. I want you to be too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's the simple thing. I mean, what I believed in going into this is that, you know, we in New South Wales, you know, one, didn't believe in ourselves and didn't believe how special this place was. We'd almost got used to New South Wales. Whatever statistic was put up, whatever league table, we'd fallen off the back of the truck. You know, we were back of the pack across everything. I think that we've started to move away from that. We've started, you know, whether it be economically, and we have made some traction economically, whether we have been infrastructure, we have started to move back towards the pace setter in the country, and I think that's important. But as I look forward, I can't help but be incredibly excited about what New South Wales is about to become. I mean, we're about to have the most incredible convention and exhibition centre across Asia Pacific, and that is being constructed as we speak right down at Darling Harbour. Mm. We are undertaking the largest public transport project in the history of the country in terms of the North West Rail Link, the largest road project in the history of the country, the West Connects project. I mean, people in Parramatta, to get to Sydney Airport, it'll be 40 minutes quicker. There's 3,000 trucks a day that are going to be taken off Parramatta Road. We're building, you know, one of the most modern hospitals in the world at the Northern Beaches, that is starting to sort of grow up. I mean, the money is there. The procurement's close to being completed. That is going to sort of take place. The Pacific Highway is actually finally going to be dual. I mean, it has been a long time coming. That has happened. Regional New South Wales is going through this most incredible opportunity because that asset recycling we've spoken about, 30% of the funds are actually being quarantined for regional New South Wales. So there's roads and hospitals that are undertaking that are going to transform many communities across the state. So as I look to where New South Wales and Sydney is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years, it is an incredibly dynamic place. I mean, as the cranes come in, the jobs come in, the economic growth gets stronger, but it's the day-to-day impact. You know, less congestion on a daily basis. We have the best healthcare sort of coming. I mean, on the Northern Beaches, we've got old, run-down hospitals, incredible staff. Well, the incredible staff about to get an incredible facility, and that is going to transform the healthcare, as it's doing across many other parts of New South Wales. So I can't help but be excited where New South Wales is, but just as importantly, where it's going. And, you know, that's before you get to the natural beauty. You know, it is. I've had the real privilege of working around the world. But when I look at some of our coastline, some of our national parks, I mean, New South Wales is one of the most beautiful spots in the world. So we're very lucky to be here. But New South Wales is on a trajectory, I think, unlike we've seen in a long, long time.
Mike Baird, you're a busy man. I thank you for the time that you could spend with us on Open House around Australia.
Real pleasure.